You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hithloday. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great writers for ATQ, Adam Holland. How you doing, Adam?
I'm doing well. It's good to be back. Ready to go over some of the new topics we've been covering the last couple weeks.
Well, the first one we should talk about is a somber one. It's been a week since we received the news that Spencer Webb died in an accident. You wrote an article about it that went up today in memoriam of Spencer Webb. What were your feelings about the guy?
Honestly, it's just, like I said, it's kind of a tough thing to wrap your head around sometimes. You know, I mentioned that in the article that, you know, especially when you really see somebody just kind of entering the prime of their life, you know, they got their future right ahead of them and everything, for something like that to happen, it's really difficult thing to kind of grasp. And, you know, as much as, you know, the players and teammates are feeling it, you know, his friends and family are feeling it even more. So, yeah, always a tough thing. And just, you know, thoughts and prayers are with anybody that was, you know, close to him at this point.
Yeah, it's particularly poignant where, you know, when anybody loses their life before it's their time. But, you know, in particular, I think, you know, with college athletes and college football players in particular, that, like, you know, they're so young and they're so vital. And I mean, they literally dress like comic book heroes. And, you know, the idea that they're mortal and as fragile as anyone else is, you know, it's shocking. You know, and this isn't the first Oregon football player to, you know, die in an accidental death, and probably won't be the last. We go through this every once in a while, and there's never, you know, anything that anybody can say to make it better or nicer, or, you know, not a sort of grim reminder of our own mortality. I hope everybody stays safe is about the only thing that I can say. And the other thing that I feel is appropriate for us to talk about, given our role as sports writers, is, you know, what Spencer Webb's career at Oregon, you know, meant, which, you know, I felt like, I don't know, maybe you feel differently, but I felt like it never really lived up to its full potential. And that, but maybe he was looking at that in 2022. And, you know, it doesn't add to the tragedy. It is a tragedy all on its own. But it was it was painful for me because, like, I really felt like Spencer Webb was going to have a great season, that, you know, the way that this offense was setting up, I really felt was going to use him better than he had been used by previous staffs, and to see that cut short, it really hurt.
Yeah, absolutely. And no, I do agree with that take. I think one thing to liken it to was, interestingly enough, I brought up in my article that during his freshman season or redshirt freshman season, when he was playing more consistently, was with that historic 2019 squad. And he actually ended up filling in for Jacob Breland, who at the time, I think, was having the kind of breakout that I was kind of expecting from Spencer. Breland was kind of like sparsely used from here to there. And then kind of just all of a sudden he really started, you know, when they had kind of the new offense instituted, it was more more based on just kind of like the downhill passing game. Breland really started to thrive in that. And then unfortunately, like I said, he had the season ending injury, and then kind of Spencer Webb had to step in for that. I was expecting something kind of similar from Spencer Webb. I was thinking that maybe, like you said, given the new offensive scheme and everything, that he really might have a breakout performance in the first half of the season, at least. And to see that happen right when it's on the cusp of something special is hard to deal with, for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, in 2019. Well, really, for the last couple of years, you know, at Oregon, the tight end situation was, I mean, it was messed up, right? Like, you know, Jacob Breland broke his leg. And in 2020, the health, you know, Patrick Herbert, little brother of Justin, who came in as a four-star in 2019, you know, that guy's had health problems his entire, you know, his entire time at Oregon, you know, which is undeserved. You know, it was so bad that in 2020, DJ Johnson was, you know, they had to force him into action. And Hunter Campmoyer, who's, you know, converted defensive end, you know, was forced into action in 2019 and in 2020. And like, you know, I can tell you from the film that like those guys, you know, they're converted defensive ends for a reason, you know, like you could see it in sort of, you know, the way that they would catch passes. And then you'd watch Spencer Webb's film and you're like, yeah, that guy's a tight end. You know, that dude got hands like that dude, you know, and so finally, like looking at 2022, it was like, oh, good. You know, finally a chance for this dude to shine, you know, where it's like they had sufficient, you know, number of good blocking tight ends that they could actually afford to sort of go back and use Spencer Webb in 2019 the way that like God intended him to be used, which is sort of as a big Y receiver, you know, because, you know, the messed up, the reason that I talked about sort of the messed up health situation of Oregon's tight end room was that like Spencer Webb was just not as good, you know, good of a blocker, just wasn't built that way. I don't think as some of the other tight ends, but like, that dude's great as a big wide receiver sort of split out, which like you can be as a good tight end. You know, Mike Gesicki at Penn State, for example, was that way. Dude's a lousy blocker. He's an NFL tight end because he's a great receiver. And I felt like the way that, you know, from having watched Kenny Dillingham's tape and, you know, with Ferguson and Mathisbaugh kind of locking down those like blocking tight end, you know, roles, that like Spencer Webb was really like freed up to do that sort of stuff. And then his life was cut short and it sucks. You have an article coming up, it's sort of just a coincidence that you're going to be writing about two tight ends in a row, about Cam McCormick, who's, you know, may surprise some fans, is still on the roster. He was last seriously playing in 2017. In fact, I wrote an article about him back in 2020 that had to go back to his 2017 tape to put film out, you know, on the guy. I think he's really good. You know, the 2017 tape was really encouraging. He was competing for reps with Jacob Breland back at the time. He was, you know, his year behind, and so he was getting fewer, but like it was good tape. And then, I mean, walk us through the sort of injury situation with Cam McCormick. I mean, if it wasn't a young man getting hurt, it would be funny. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It really, it's kind of like you know, like you said, like it's not funny that he's been injured, but it's almost kind of like you look at it as like a dark joke, how his time at U of O has gone. And just the fact that, like you said, you have to go so far back to find, reasonable game footage of the guy, that you're going back to when Justin Herbert, who is now, you know, one of the top quarterbacks in the NFL, was a sophomore at Oregon. Yeah. And just to think that much time has passed since he's even been able to, you know, play a good chunk of the season, and that he's still here on the roster. And this really is, you know, his like he's exhausted every sort of eligibility.
I mean, he's a mega senior. I mean, I always had, I think, 3 years of medical red shirts. And here's the crazy thing. You know, I swear this is not the dump on Jacob Breeland podcast, but in 2018, he really did beat Jacob Breeland out for the starting job. Like, I had to do that film study on that Bowling Green tape. He really is, like, they were playing two tight ends in that first quarter. He made it through the end of one quarter of one game in 2018. But he really was the first tight end on the field. It was him and Jacob Breeland, and he was getting more, of the reps. And then he gets injured in that game. He misses the rest of the season. And then 2019, we don't have film to confirm this because it apparently happened in fall camp, but, you know, I have no difficulty believing it because it did happen the year before. He beat out Jacob Breeland again in 2019. And then didn't play. And then he wasn't available at all in 2020. A lot of people weren't available at all in 2020. And then in 2021, Spencer Webb's on the team. They've got two great, true freshmen I mentioned a second ago, Ferguson and Matavau. So it's a full room. And the play that we'll all remember, at the Ohio State game, they're in Columbus, they're backed up on their own goal line. And it's a third down, got to have it. Or because if they have to punt, they're going to give Ohio State really great field position. And instead, the ball goes to Cam McCormick. He gets the first down. He takes a hit, goes down with injury. That's it. His season's done. And then, his gallantry is, it stands regardless of what would have happened. But I'll mention what happened anyway. Oregon goes on to score a touchdown on that drive in a game that they end up winning by 7 points. It's not hyperbole to say Cam McCormick won that game for Oregon.
Definitely.
And then if this stuff was in a movie, was in a sports movie, you'd be throwing your popcorn at the screen. You're just like, this is so corny. This is such a hack writing, whoever's coding the simulation for this, like, come on, take a script writing class.
You can talk about a cruel irony, but that was maybe even beyond that. Just the fact that, the first significant big catch and big play that he's made in years, and he gets hurt on that play. And it really is kind of like a Pandora's box at this point. We're really not sure exactly what we're going to see from Cam McCormick. There's been so many seasons now that it's kind of like been like, heading in, you're like, ooh, okay, yeah, Cam McCormick, yeah, I'm excited about this. But at this point, you're just, it's more uncertainty rather than excitement. So, like, that's kind of what I'm going to get into in the article. Do we have real reason to be excited about it? And there is some reason to be excited about it, but there's also a lot of understandably cautious, cautious optimism, because at this point it's like, what else could really happen? And you almost like don't even want to say that and jinx it, but it really has been the story with him, unfortunately.
And, the thing is, if he's not healthy and Herbert's not healthy and Webb is unfortunately no longer with us, it's two true sophomores in the Oregon's tight end room, Maliki Matavau and Terrence Ferguson. Now, I like those two a lot. Those two, may very well be the best pair of tight ends in the conference. It's just that, the number of available scholarship tight ends that Oregon will have is, you know, may very well be limited to those two guys. And we don't know what's going to happen, you know, if that's the case. It may be that that's just fine. That's all you need. Hell, maybe one more than they need. You know, Dillingham tends to run 11 personnel offenses. But I don't know, you know, it's a scary situation. You know, I hope it doesn't sound too macabre to pivot so quickly from mourning Spencer Webb to like, well, how does this affect the Ducks? But like, I feel like Spencer Webb's a competitor. He would want to know how this is going to affect the Ducks. I can't imagine a more fitting tribute than talking about like how his absence will affect his team on the field. And it may be significant.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think that's kind of, interestingly enough, before I learned of his passing, I was, you know, going to delve into an article about Cam McCormick and kind of like what he would even bring to the team. And now, like I said, I've kind of had to change that up a little bit and make it a little more prevalent, because then you have the absence of Webb. You know, I was thinking of writing that article with Webb on the team. Mm-hmm. And so now with Webb gone, you're looking at, like you said, just, you know, two sophomores, very talented, highly rated, you know, sophomores, but, you know, sophomores nonetheless that don't have like a bevy of playing time, don't have a whole lot of experience, you know, still need to get their blocking down, get their, you know, their hands nice mm-hmm. and sticky for those catches. Is Cam McCormick, you know, does he really become option numero uno at this point? And it's just it's hard to think like that, because I think Oregon over the last decade at least, and even looking beyond that, has been pretty fortunate with some of the tight ends they've been able to have. But at the same time, you know, they've had some tight end situations where some difficult things happened. You know, you had Pharaoh Brown with that injury that I could have threatened his life even. Yeah. And it was nice. It was so great to see him come back from that, be able to finish his senior season, even though the last season he played was infamously one of the worst seasons Oregon has had in decades. But the fact that he was able to still get back on the field and complete that. And then even going back before him, you have probably the most athletic, dangerous tight end as far as pure skill that I think I've ever seen Oregon have in Colt Laerla. And then it just turned out to be a situation where it was a guy that just could not keep his life in order, could not keep it together. And unfortunately, just because of that, similar to, you know, Cliff Harris, wasted probably one of the best talents they ever had at the position. So it's a long road leading up to Cam McCormick's, you know, last hurrah here. And, yeah, but like I said, I'm definitely going to deal with possibilities.
It's why I said, you know, you're absolutely right. Like you've got to go back pretty far in Oregon history at this point to find like an unmitigated, you know, tight end season for Oregon where you're just like, this was great. You know, we are nothing but smiles, you know, about this tight end situation. It's been a minute. And, you know, honestly, you know, I shouldn't say this out loud because I'm going to jinx it if I do, but like if Cam McCormick is healthy and he leads this team, you know, he comes back after four missed seasons and comes back and finishes the season healthy, you know, sell the rights to Hollywood, man. Like, I mean, what a comeback, you know, that would be. I mean, that kid's going to graduate with a doctorate and grandkids from the University of Oregon at this point. And, you know, if you haven't read any of the stories about, you know, what he's had to go through in terms of rehab every year, I mean, it's inspiring. And
it is. It really is. And that's why, like I said, it's almost kind of, you know, I had to stop myself from being too biased in the article and turning it into a, you know, how much I'm rooting for him kind of article.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk some women's basketball.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
So the article that you had written previously, Adam, was about the Hina Pau Pau and the women's basketball team. It was a little bit of a retrospective on how the 2021-2022 season went, but also sort of looking forward to Pau Pau's leadership and what this team could be. What do you think that is for her and for the team?
Well, the thing that I think most people just kind of need to wrap their heads around is that don't start writing off Oregon women's basketball just yet. I know that it's been tough, and everybody feels like, you know, we got nixed at our one biggest chance to really, you know, bring home that national title and everything. And, you know, looking at it in retrospect, yeah, at the time we did, for sure. Can things get back to that level? I really do believe that they can. But what I went into a little bit with the Tahina Pau Pau article was kind of pointing out that after you had that historic 2020 team that accomplished what they accomplished, you brought in...
And then got robbed of what could have been a national championship.
You ended up bringing in one of the best classes that, you know, like that anyone has ever seen. It was a consensus, undisputed number one class in the country. You had five-star players all across the board. And at that point, you know, the sting of not getting the chance to go after the national title that year was eased a little bit by the fact that, like, look at this talent we're bringing in. Look, you know, look at this. This could be a national title in the making. And you just never really know till you get them on the court or on the field in college. And from that class, Tahina was the one member that has kind of lived up to her billing. And so, not trying to throw too much pressure onto her, but she is kind of starting to seem like Oregon's central hope in getting back to that elite level. The reason being is because she has proven that, like I said, she lives up to her billing and she puts up the stats and has the performances on the court to back it up. Now, I think what will be most important for her, especially heading into, you know, her upperclassmen years, is to really become that on-court general. And it's really difficult, you know, to follow in the footsteps of somebody that's Oregon's all-time great. You know what I mean? It's obviously he performed extremely well, but I kind of liken it to Vernon Adams coming in after Marcus Mariota. It's like, okay, how can you ever live up to that? Well, how can you ever live up to Sabrina Ionescu? But I don't necessarily expect her to live up to that as much as I like to see the effect that she has on the team compared to what Sabrina had on the team. Now, you had players with Sabrina that would show up and they would play. You know, you had Ruthie Hebert, you had Satu Sabali, you had Aaron Boley. They would, you know, play their roles to perfection. Now, do I think that they would have played those roles to such perfection without an on-court general like Sabrina on the team? Maybe not. And there's a legitimate argument for that. And so I think that, like, that's what Tahina needs to focus on, is really being that kind of on-court presence, that the player that you go to and the one that really kind of raises the game of those around her to the highest level as the point guard and as the court on-court leader and, you know, kind of the maestro of the whole offense.
Well, you're right about that. You know, it's not entirely, you know, up to her, you know, too. It's a fair comparison to make to Ionescu, you know, because this team, you know, it does have other, you know, great players coming back, you know, like Sedona Prince and Indy Rogers. And, you know, like you mentioned, the, you know, recruiting has been, you know, hadn't missed a beat, you know, the, you know, this most, you know, recent recruiting class includes, you know, a bunch of blue chips, right? You know, Grace Van Sluten, Jenna Asai, Kennedy Basham, Chance Gray, right? You know, it seems to be the way that, you know, college basketball is going in the, over the last decade or so, is like, yeah, those kids are freshmen, but like, so what? You know, you're a freshman, you know, blue chip, you're going to play, you know, right away. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how that, you know, how that balance works, you know, between Pau Pau and Prince and Rogers and some of the young hotshots. The other thing that's interesting about the women's basketball team is, you know, usually a good sign for a basketball team is that they have a healthy amount of turnover on the staff because other programs want your staff. There's already, you know, there's already one departure, the director of, I think the official title for Audie Gilden was a director of creativity or student athlete support. You know, I honestly am not entirely sure what that job entails, but given how, you know, the upswelling of social media, you know, support for her, you know, when it was announced that the University of Seattle, not the University of Washington at Seattle, but the private university, hired her as an assistant coach. Yeah. So, you know, Oregon support staff, moving up, you know, a great sign. And then, and then somebody that, Oregon basketball fans, who've been around for a minute will remember, Mike Moser. Kelly Graves brought him on as an assistant coach. He played for Oregon a while ago. I think it was at UCLA, prior to that. He was hired as an assistant coach. He was part of this most, you know, the recruiting class that I just mentioned with Van Sluten and Basham and Gray and Asai. He's gotten hired too by the Boston Celtics. You know, hell of a promotion for that guy. You know, I haven't officially assigned you to write an article about this yet, Adam, although I have in the past been in the habit of handing out assignments on this podcast. It must be electric for our listeners. You got any thoughts about Moser or Gilden moving up?
Yeah, I'm definitely in agreement with you. I would, yeah, maybe like to delve in a little bit on Moser, just because of the connection that he had with UO. And, you know, his playing days and all that. But I'm in agreement with you that that's a good sign. Anytime you have a program where your coaching staff is getting pulled up, that has to mean that they're doing something right. And in previous years, you know, especially with women's basketball, you definitely weren't seeing that as much because it was just like, well, they weren't on the map. They weren't making enough noise to be like, oh, they're really doing this well. What can this person who works for them bring to our organization? And now you're seeing that a lot more. And I think it's amazing that Moser was pulled all the way up to the Boston Celtics. I mean, now you're talking, you know, working for one of the more historic sports franchises in the country, if not the world, and in kind of like, you know, an environment where it's like, This is a young upstart team that just made the NBA finals and came a few games shy of winning a championship. Also, interestingly enough, the connection between, you know, Peyton Pritchard now playing a significant role for the Celtics and Mike Moser heading over there. Yeah, I think there's definitely enough material.
They don't overlap. You know, Moser was, I think, last at Oregon in 2014, and Pritchard doesn't start until 2016. But like,
yeah,
you know, once a duck, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I also like that there. I have, you know, just anecdotally, I've been noticing more back and forth moves between men's and women's basketball coaching. You know, it seemed like in the past they were really siloed, and that a lot of times, coaches, you know, who were just getting started didn't want to, didn't want to coach on the women's side because they felt like, I'm just guessing here, but I think it's a reasonable inference, you know, that they didn't want to get pigeonholed, you know, as women's basketball only coach and feel like they're, you know, that their options would be limited, you know, moving forward. And I don't think that's true anymore. You know, and I think that, you know, Mike Moser is a pretty good example of that, you know, that like, and there are other examples going the other way too. You know, there are women's basketball coaches who come over from the men's side, you know, and vice versa. You know, I think it's a good sign, you know, of the sport maturing and moving forward. And, you know, honestly, it makes me proud to see, you know, former Oregon player and former Oregon coach, you know, demonstrating that kind of flexibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk some Oregon Ducks football.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle, a run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Well, Adam, I published my 60th duck dive article, my time writing for Addicted to Quack. It has been 5 years, starting the 2018 season, in which I previewed all 12 Pac-12 teams. There still are 12 teams in the Pac-12 for the moment. So this was, you know, the most recent of them. I always save Oregon for last for obvious reasons. It has been an excellent project. All thanks go to Adam Chimeo, our emeritus glorious leader, who hosts the podcast that we do our podcast interviews on. Basically, that's my like cheat is, you know, like I write sort of a rough draft version of the article, and then I essentially read my rough draft to some poor sod that we've roped in who writes about the other team, you know, and be like, did I miss anybody? Did I screw this up? Did I miscategorize this person? And then I, you know, get all that, like, you know, I don't have an editor now, but that person is my editor, you know, but I don't have anybody to do that for me for Oregon. Like I gotta like get the stuff figured out on my own. It's tragic. I know. I can feel the sympathy coming through the microphone from you, Adam. but you know, the other thing that I can say about it is about saving Oregon for last is that, like, you know, Oregon's the most talented team in the conference. I hope that is not a controversial thing to say. You know, it is, like, you can verify, you can look at the 247, you know, ratings. It's also a very well balanced roster, and, you know, in something of a surprise, given that the entire coaching staff turned over it and they had some departures, you know, is sort of inevitable when these things happen. It remains a well balanced roster. You know, it's really hard to poke holes in the team. You know, it's a little thin at cornerback, but that's pretty much it. It's, you know, this, I've actually been pretty impressed with the job this staff has done in terms of, like, you know, they took some judicious transfers to pave in some holes, and, you know, they kept guys from leaving who were getting itchy, and, you know, otherwise, or, you know, but, you know, they inherited a cupboard that was well stocked. You know, one of the things that I said on Adam Chimeo's podcast was that, like, you know, I know that we're all constitutionally required to hate Mario Cristobal now, but, like, you got to give it up for the dude. He stocked Oregon's cupboards, right?
Yeah, no, 100%. Like I said, it's a love-hate relationship. We're definitely going to kind of benefit from a lot of the talent that he brought in. But I agree with your take that the new coaching staff seems to be just kind of like picking up where he left off, in a sense. I don't see the Oregon brand really suffering any big setbacks at this point. They still really present themselves, at least on paper, like you said, as the most talented team in the conference, kind of, you know, like the pride of the Pac-12. Now, obviously, that has to be proven on the field because we all thought that last year until Utah came along and pretty much just out-toughed us and everything and outclassed us. Can't let that kind of thing happen. Got to stay focused on that. But yeah, I think it's perfectly reasonable to assume that Oregon will be right there competing for the Pac-12 title this year, given the kind of talent they have, given what this coaching staff has shown, how well they can adapt. And yeah, it's looking like it's going to be a pretty fun season in a couple months.
Well, you know, I think you're right that they're probably, they got a date with the Pac-12 title game, even though they, you know, the conference has done away with divisions, like, simply because, you know, look, I know the non-con is brutal. You know, I don't know who thought it was a good idea to play Georgia in Atlanta. I don't know who thought it was a good idea to schedule Eastern Washington, you know, one of the most dangerous FCS teams in existence. I don't know who thought it was a good idea to schedule BYU, you know, who's coming off a couple great seasons. You know, technically, you know, this is a team that's going to be playing 11 Power 5 teams when, you know, if you think about BYU in that way. On the other hand, the, you know, and so therefore, like, 2-1 or maybe even 1-2, you know, out of the non-con is possibility. But the conference schedule sets up really nicely for the Ducks. Like, you know, just restricting themselves to the Pac-12, they miss USC, you know, usually it's, you know, pretty good. They miss ASU, which, like, you know, okay, I understand that team may be a dumpster fire by the end of the year, but, like, they're still right in the middle of the pack in terms of talent. And, like, I'd, you know, and that team sort of strikes me as a cornered animal. You know, like, if I'm the Ducks, I'd rather miss ASU than miss Colorado or miss Arizona. Like, I know that everybody's, like, rooting for Jed Fish now, and as well they might, but just, like, you know, if you just, you know, even though that guy's, you know, made a big talent leap for Arizona, they're still way behind Arizona State. You can't miss USC and UCLA. The Pac-12 rules forbid that, at least for now, which means, like, there's only one possible way the schedule could be better, which is, you know, be missing Utah instead of UCLA. So, like, okay, it's the second best schedule conceivable. But, like, the five road games that they play are Wazoo, Arizona, Colorado, Cal, and Oregon State. Those are the five least talented teams in the conference. I mean, literally, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, you know, least talented teams. And the four, you know, home games that they get are, you know, Oregon's got to be licking their chops because it's, you know, it's UCLA, you know, who might be a danger. It's Utah, who they're looking for revenge. It's Washington, always a game. And it's Stanford, and, you know, you better believe they're looking for revenge against Stanford, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, it sets up pretty nicely for, you know, I'm not going to say 9-0 because there's no such thing as 9-0 in the Pac-12. I mean, literally, there's no such thing as 9-0 in the history of the Pac-12, but, like, it's setting up for, you know, if they're not 8-1 in conference, I'd kind of be shocked, not shocked, but, like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm sort of like, if they're not 8-1, something went wrong, you know?
Yeah, you know. Absolutely. I think an interesting thing to keep an eye on this season too, is that this may have kind of flown over people's heads, pardon the pun, but Oregon is in the midst of one of their longest home winning streaks in football history, a streak that we haven't seen since Akili Smith and Joey Harrington were under center for Oregon. They have not lost a home game since September of 2018 at this point.
Yeah, another bizarre loss to Stanford. Yeah. I don't know what it is about those guys.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if you...
David Shaw and his bizarre shit.
The craziness of that one, right. You could be looking at an even longer streak. And that's what I think is really going to be interesting. I think you have two teams coming in to Oregon's house that could really challenge that streak in BYU and particularly Utah. Interestingly enough, you know, they're both from, you know, the same state, and they're rivals in themselves. Mm-hmm. I do think that, you know, like you said, you know, you look at BYU and you think, oh, not a power, but no, BYU is the real deal. They've proven they're the real deal.
They're the only, you know, Pac-12 undefeated Pac-12 teams last year.
Yeah,
exactly. 5-0 against the Pac-12.
Yeah, and so you know, you have them coming in for, I think, you know, what's maybe being overlooked a little bit simply because of the magnitude of the Georgia game. But this is one of the bigger non-conference opponents to visit Autzen Stadium in quite some time. And we all know, looking back, you know, to the 90s, through the 2000s, and even to the 2010s, what's happened when big non-conference opponents come to Autzen Stadium. And it generally has boded pretty well for Oregon. And so I'm really looking forward to that, and particularly the game against Utah. You know, this is going to be, by that point, it's really going to be, you know, the season's starting to wind down. It's in November. Both teams have figured out what they're all about and everything. It'll be very similar to last year, except that Oregon is going to have revenge on their mind. And so,
and home field, I think
that might be one of the most intriguing things to look at is these two huge games at Autzen Stadium, where Oregon has not had a blemish in years now.
Yeah. And the other thing, you know, about, you know, Oregon going last in this series, and then as soon as I'm done with it, you know, I'm going to pivot and I'm going to start writing about, you know, Georgia. I've got film study coming up for the next couple of weeks. I'm going to be, you know, really diving into Georgia's film. I've already done some preliminary stuff just so I can speak semi-intelligently about Dan Lanning's defense. But, you know, I'm going to have a full article breaking down, you know, Dan Lanning's mint front defense, which I'm obviously going to be referencing quite a bit of Georgia film in order to do. And then, of course, I'm going to write a big, you know, preview article of, you know, the Georgia Bulldogs, because they're Oregon's opener. And, you know, so I construct, you know, the same type of roster database for Georgia as I do for any of the Pac-12 teams in this series, you know, and I use those same tools to, you know, for Ohio State, you know, for the last couple of years and well, you know, all of Oregon's opponents, frankly, and, you know, I've had to do it a lot, you know, lately I did for Auburn, you know, before that, and several other teams. And I did it for Oklahoma, you know, and, you know, so, you know, two different SEC teams, you know, and, you know, and blue bloods and so, you know, I have those, I have spreadsheets, you know, made up, you know, out of my database, you know, in which I, you know, color code these things so that I can talk about them on podcasts with easy visual references. And like the way that those sheets look for Oklahoma, for Ohio State, for Auburn, for Georgia, those sheets look a lot more like Oregon's sheets than Oregon's sheet looks like Pac-12 sheets. You know, like Oregon is really separating itself, and the stuff that I'm referring to is not just like what their talent level is, but like how balanced it is across classes. You know, like I have visual systems that let me see, like, when did kids, you know, start playing college football? When did they start getting playing time? You know, are transfers coming in who are like, you know, jumping the queue, you know, in front of you. And that's what I see like consistently out of the, you know, the SEC teams and the blue bloods, is that like, it's this orderly progression. You know, they take the freshman red shirt, that, you know, that they get more playing time as sophomores, they get more playing time as juniors, and they go to the NFL. So it was very consistent, like, you know, treadmill of success. And I don't see the treadmill of success at 11 out of 12 Pac-12 teams. You know, I really, that's sort of like one of the reasons I save Oregon for the last, is that it's like, and now to talk about a team that takes football seriously. And, you know, maybe USC is going to be taking football seriously in the future, but Lincoln Riley is inheriting a roster where, like, famously that dude's had to take, like, you know, look at all the transfers, right? Like he's, you know, been forced into that situation. And like, I really like the way that Oregon's roster sets up. You know, like they're loaded at the skill talent, you know, positions. Like every one of the skill talent players that they are likely to play, with the exception of Noah Whittington, who's himself a proven commodity, at least, you know, he got like 101 carries last year. Every one of them are four stars, right? Like Cardwell, Marquise Irving, Jordan James, you know, the running backs, Terrence Ferguson, Leaky Matavow, the tight ends, Patrick Herbert, the entire wide receiver core. I mean, literally every single one of them, Chris Hudson, Seth McGee, you know, Josh Delgado, Justice Lowe, Troy Franklin, Donnie Thornton, Isaiah Crawford, Isaiah Brizard, Chase Cota, Caleb Chapman, Kyler Casper, every single human being that I just mentioned, the entirety of Oregon's wide receiver core, four stars. This has never happened before. You know, that they are returning all five starters in the offensive line and two, you know, experienced backups. They, you know, on the defensive line, this is like kind of technical, but like you know, not only do they have a bunch of experienced dudes, but like, you know, and, you know, a deep rotation, but like everybody is the right body type, you know, for this three down front, like the body types that you want for Zero and 4i are simply different than the type of body types that you are looking for, you know, with four down front, you know, where you're putting on, you know, a one, a three, and a couple of sixes, for example. Like, for example, Christian Williams left the team and, you know, we're all sad, but that his body type is not, you know, he's not big enough to play nose and he's not long enough to play a 4i. That dude is meant to be like a three tech. And he transferred to Mizzou where, you know, should surprise no one, they play a 4-2-5, you know, and I don't know anything about Mizzou other than that, but like, I wouldn't be surprised if he starts playing right away. 'Cause he's really good. He was a four star, you know, it's just his body type didn't fit the system. So like, yeah, entirely appropriate that, you know, he transfers out like, but everybody else, like literally everybody else in the room, they're going to run four deep at nose tackle. And they're all appropriate bodies. They're all 300 pounds. You know, they all are that sort of like, you know, appropriate body type for it. Every one of the four eyes, Dorlas, Maya, Ware Hudson, Pody, Keanu Williams, Jake Shipley, Michael Afiasi, you know, Casey Rogers, the other Nebraska transfer, Ben Roberts, the true freshman, like every one of them, like I pulled up their, you know, I pulled up their huddle film just to double check on this, even for, you know, for Roberts. And it's like, yes, the, you know, long arms, 280 pounds. Like, yes, there you go. That's what you want. You know, you want dudes who are like 6'3", 6'4", 6'5", long arms and about 280 pounds to play 4i and clog the B gap in the tight front. It's like, you know, perfect. That, you know, the outside linebackers, they lose Kayvon Thibodeau. I know, you know, it's real sad. They're probably not going to have that like otherworldly pass rush, but they return Mace Funa and Braden Swinson and DJ Johnson, who are all, you know, look great. And, you know, it's deep too, you know, a bunch of backups who got playing time last year, like Brandon Buckner, inside linebackers. I mean, like we've gone this long, we haven't talked about, they've got Justin Flo and Nuo Sewell, a pair of five stars at inside linebacker. And because of the injury situation last year, all these, you know, all the backups are super experienced. Jeff Bassa and Keith Brown and Jackson LeDuc and, you know, all these guys, they've got two true freshmen who played in spring game, Devin Jackson, Heroes and Taggart, look really good. Like the cornerback situation, I mean, it's thin, you know, like they're going to have to hope that Christian Gonzalez and Dante Manning are healthy the entire year, but like, it's talented, right? Like Avanti Dickerson is a four star, Jill Tuckle's a four star, Jill Florence is a four star, you know, like if one of those guys takes an injury, but you know, another one of the four stars step up, they could still be just fine. You know, like young corners tend to get beat, I know, but like it is a more talented group. They just need like three more experienced bodies and I'd be raving about it, or not even three, maybe one, and then the safeties, you know, finally, you know, looks like this group is, you know, healthy again. They got a bunch of good news, you know, Bennett Williams is healthy again, you know, Jamal Hill comes back, Triquez Bridges is coming over from the cornerback room, who's, you know, he's built more like a safety. Damon David returned to the team, JJ Greenfield returned to the team, Jonathan Flo, the little brother Justin, got converted, you know, from a linebacker to a safety. You know, they got two, you know, really good looking four star freshmen in Trajan Williams and Kamari Terrell. Okay, I just named Oregon's entire roster. You know, I don't think I missed a single human being. I apologize about that. I missed the quarterbacks, Bo Nix and Ty Thompson, Jay Butterfield, in case anybody was curious about that and didn't know. I just named the entire Oregon roster on scholarship. you're welcome. But, you know, my point is, like, do you hear me name a two-star? Do you hear me name like a, you know, there is actually one walk on Ryan Walk, appropriately named, you know, did you hear me name, you know, any position, you know, besides cornerbacks, that's thin or a single position at all in which they're not starting like experienced dudes, you know, who play, you know, every one of these dudes has played extensive college football. I just ran through this entire list, including what Oregon's two deep is likely to be. Every one of them has played college football extensively before. Like none of them are like, oh, I guess we'll find out if that dude lives up to his recruiting ranking. Nope. Like, you know, it is talented. It is experienced. It is well-balanced across classes and positions. There's none of these things like I encounter with the other teams in the Pac-12 where it's like, oh yeah, you got a really great recruiting class, but it's entirely entirely at these three positions and you forgot to recruit your lines, or you got a bunch of dudes on the defensive line, but everybody else is leaving your team, you know, in and out. It looks like a dumpster fire. You know, I think we all know what team I'm talking about there. you know, like it is absolutely remarkable. And just, you know, I know this is not a visual medium, but I am looking at a color coded spreadsheet. When I look at Oregon's color coded spreadsheet, and then I tab over and look at every other Pac-12 team, Oregon doesn't look like it belongs. It looks like it belongs what I have, you know, with the teams in the other end, which is the non-con, you know, teams. It looks like, I'm not saying that Oregon has Ohio State's roster. It doesn't have Georgia's roster. It doesn't have Oklahoma's roster. It actually kind of has a pretty comparable roster to Auburn. Auburn weirdly under-recruited a few positions, but side note, like Oregon doesn't look like it belongs in the Pac-12. Like their roster, it's just qualitatively different. You know, that it's not quite, you know, like I said, it's not Georgia or Ohio State's. I haven't done this project for Alabama or Clemson's, but I sort of imagine that Alabama and Clemson look the same way, where it's like it's nothing but five stars and four stars, and it's super orderly, and there's, you know, zero or only one maybe transfer. You know, but it looks more like that, you know, than other Pac-12 teams, where it's just this cobbled together hodgepodge of two stars and guesses and like, uh-huh. Oops, we graduated all our linebackers and I have no idea if this dude could play. Or like, okay, they're going through some scheme changes, right? Oregon's going through some scheme changes. They got a new offensive coordinator and a new defensive coordinator. Did they, you know, so Joe Moorhead was an RPO 11 personnel guy. Who'd they hire? Kenny Dillingham. Well, I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to run. You know what I'm pretty sure he's not going to run is like John Donovan's flipping offense, or Mark Sanford's, you know, offense, where it's like, oh, we're going to run jumbo sets and under center stuff. Like, no, man, you know, Kenny Dillingham's going to wind up running an offense that looks an awful lot like Joe Moorhead, and it's going to be a fairly smooth transition into an 11 personnel, spread option offense. You know, like, are there going to be some different wrinkles and different priorities? Yeah, of course. But like the positions all map on just fine. And on the defense, right? Like, you know, okay, Oregon's been playing, you know, a three down front for all these years, right? Like ever since Brady Hoke got fired at the end of 2016, Oregon's been in a three down front with an outside linebacker, two ILBs and a nickel on the back end. They did that for Jim Leavitt. They did that with Andy Avalos. They did that with Tim DeRuiter. Again, all those guys sort of had different priorities. You know, there's a stud backer for Avalos and you know, et cetera. But like, but the personnel all maps on appropriately, right? Like, you know, I the reason I spent all that time talking about like the four eyes and how they differ from a four down front is because that's what the Oregon body type is. And these 11 other teams, Pac-12 teams, like how many times did I say on these podcasts, just like, well, they're going through a scheme change and none of the bodies fit. And so I don't know how this is going to work. It's going to be, you know, a year or two before they make that adjustment. Is that going to be a problem for Oregon? No, sir. You know, they got dudes where these guys map cleanly onto their new jobs and no one's going to have to relearn football from scratch or try to fit their body type into a scheme that doesn't, you know, match what they want to do. I save Oregon for the end for obvious reasons, but in many ways I should do Oregon first. So I could be like, okay, this is how you're supposed to manage a roster. And now with that in mind, we'll look at how all the other Pac-12 teams are screwing it up. Cause that's what they're doing, man. Like, it's just astonishing. It's just astonishing how unprofessional the roster management is for the other 11 teams in this league. I've been ranting for a while, and for anybody who's not an Oregon fan who's listening to this is getting mad at me, like, don't get mad at me. I'm the messenger. The people who have failed you are the people who your school is employing and paying a lot more money than anybody's paying me. Recruit better, manage your roster better, and you'll have good results. Oregon, you know, in many ways, you know, had some management problems in 2021. They won 10 games. You know why they won 10 games? Jimmy's and Joe's. Because when you manage your roster appropriately and you fill it with a lot of talent, you can have management problems and they just roll over people. And that's that.
Yeah. And I think that's something to keep in mind, too. You know, the way last season ended left a sour taste in a lot of people's mouths. But at the same time, you look at it, and you say, yeah, we had double-digit wins. They beat Ohio State in the horseshoe. And for the better part of the season, they were up there in the college football playoff conversation.
And it's like, so, even if you believe the absolute worst about Mario Cristobal, you also have to reconcile with the fact that they won 10 games. And how do you come to that conclusion? Well, you know, I'm not a pessimist about this team, but if I were doing my impression of a pessimist about this team, my impression would be about the 2021 team. I mean, well, how'd they win 10 games? Well, he just had so much of a talent advantage over all the other teams that he played that, like, he didn't have to know how to coach. Like, you know, he'd just roll over them with their talent. And he's sort of, my response to that is like, number one, oh, they just rolled over Ohio State with their talent. That's what an interesting referendum. And number two is like, okay, Oregon has a more talented team in 2022 than they had in 2021. They have a coaching staff, which I don't believe will be checked out. You know, and they enjoy a bigger talent advantage over their opponents, with the exception of Georgia, than they did last year. Like, what do you think is going to happen?
Honestly, I think it all kind of rides on just the team cohesion and their mindset. I really think from a talent standpoint, it's absolutely like you said. It's not like Utah is really on our level. They just displayed more cohesion. They had more fire to them, and they had more of a hunger to go after it. I liken it a lot to the reason that Boise State beat us a couple times in 2008 and 2009. There is no way Boise State had the more talented roster than us. They were just hungrier. They were tougher on the field, and they just kind of outclassed us. And I think as long as you see Oregon doesn't fall into that trap, I really do see them. I see absolutely no reason. No reason whatsoever this year why we will not be in a New Year's Six game. The first game against Georgia is brutal. There's no other way around it. Do I think it's more brutal than facing Ohio State in the horseshoe? Not necessarily. You know, nobody really thought we could win that game, so you really never know what's going to happen. Playing devil's advocate and just assuming that we do not beat Georgia and Atlanta, that's still probably one of the most quality losses you're going to be able to have. And sure, moving forward in that, like I said, you have two legitimate teams after that that you're facing, and they're both at home. And in all likelihood, you're going to get two shots at Utah. I don't see how they don't get two shots at Utah. And really, to make a New Year's Six game, all you have to do is beat Utah one of those times. Because if they beat them at Autzen and then lose the conference title game, at that point you're talking a team that, you know what I mean, only lost the conference title game to, you know, a ranked opponent, and at Georgia. That team's getting an at-large bid to a New Year's Six Bowl. You beat Utah, you know, like one of the two times and one of those two times in the Pac-12 title game, you're going to the Rose Bowl. So I agree with you.
I mean, a 12-1 conference champ is, I mean, I have a hard time seeing that happening, some, because like nobody ever went, like you would either have to go 9-0 and then win the conference championship game. And that way you could afford a loss to Georgia and still make the playoffs, which, you know, no one ever goes undefeated, or you have to beat Georgia and limit yourself to only one slip up in the Pac-12, which, like, come on, let's not be unrealistic. It is a new staff. You know, there's enough threats in the Pac-12. But like, so like, you know, a one loss season, I don't know if that's in the cards, but if they get it, they're going to the playoffs. Or if it's, you know, they're 12-0 going into the, if they're 12-0 going into the title game, and they lose the title game, then of course they're playing a New Year's Six Bowl, and they might wind up going to the playoffs anyway. Yeah. You know, like there are scenarios, and we, you know, non-conference champions have gone to the playoffs before. But like, I don't want to, you know, contemplate one loss, you know, scenarios. Like I don't really see that in the cards. But like,
yeah, it's dicey when you're talking one loss scenarios. That's why, like I said, I'm kind of downgrading it a bit. I'm going with a two-loss scenario, but I like the point that I'm just trying to drive home is you're going to have two shots at Utah, and you just have to win one of those to make a New Year's Six game.
Right. You know, like if it's a loss to Georgia and split, you know, 1-2 against Utah, like it's hard to imagine that Oregon doesn't make a New Year's Six bowl. And like, you know, we're discounting the possibility of losses coming from other places, right? You know, BYU could beat them. It's the Pac-12. They got to play in Pullman. They got to play in Tucson. Although I will note it's in Pullman in September before it gets real cold, and it's in Tucson in October, you know, after the worst of the heat has passed. So, you know, that's nice too.
As long as it's not Tucson in November.
You know, it's the Pac-12. It's just like, it's really hard to imagine, you know, even if they wind up beating Utah once or twice, if they see him again, you know, it's just, you know, everybody slips up, you know, this conference, man. But like, yeah, you know, I think, you know, I think, you know, not counting the, just counting the 12 teams that are currently on the schedule, like not counting any potential conference championship game or postseason stuff. You know, the odds makers have set it, I think, at 9 or 9.5. You know, and the question is whether or not you take the under or the over. And like the way that this team sets up based, you know, comparing to the West, the way that the rest of the Pac-12 sets up, you know, I gotta say, I'm going to take the over, you know. Now would the under, you know, shock me? No, you know, not at all. I think if they won 8 games, I would probably say something, you know, if a time traveling version of myself came back and told me that Oregon went 8-4, and then asked, like, how do you guess that happened? You know, my guess would be like, oh, the quarterback got injured, you know, or that they had like a really run, you know, a bad run of injuries at like at a position they can't afford it, like cornerback or something like that. You know, something went wrong. You know, but something would have to go wrong for this team to lose 4 games. The conference schedule is just so, it sets up so nicely, and the talent advantage is just so over, you know, every team that they're scheduled to play is so big. I mean, it's hard to overstate that. They miss USC, and the next most talented team in the conference is Washington. Washington took a big step back in terms of their average talent rating. Over the last 2 years, they have net lost 13 blue chips. Washington has.
And you kind of knew that was going to happen when Peterson left.
Yeah. And well, not just because, I mean, yes, that happened. But then, you know, people had talked themselves into believing that Lake was going to, oh, it's the, it were, hell, the recruiting could even improve because Chris Peterson was kind of a fuddy-duddy. But Jimmy Lake, he looks like he's a real young go-getter who could really relate with the young athletes of today. I can't imagine why they want to believe that. That definitely reflects super well on Washington's super progressive fan base. But anyway, you know, obviously that didn't happen. The 2-year Jimmy Lake period, you know, presided over a mass exodus of blue chip talent out of Washington, including bizarrely 6 blue chip defensive backs left and 0 blue chip defensive backs in, for at least comprising the 2022 roster. And that's the number 3, you know, that's the most talented team that Oregon is scheduled to play in the Pac-12.
Thank you, Washington, by the way, for that perfect three-down body that we nabbed from you for our defense, too.
You know, and thanks for the wide receiver coach, and, you know, thanks for self-destructing, you know, and giving up all the Washington talent, you know, the state of Washington talent that Oregon has recently acquired. That's the most talented team that Oregon plays, you know, a team that's got a lot of problems and that, you know, and that whose tent pole, their defensive backs, you know, is now the weakest, you know, probably in the conference, in terms of their cornerbacks, at least, like, you know, anybody in the Pac-12 beating them, with the exception of Utah, where, you know, because of what happened last year and the fact that team sort of consistently punches above its weight class, anybody in the Pac-12 beating the Ducks would be a surprise.
Like, yeah, I agree.
I guess you put it this way, they're going to be favored in every game that they play. Like,
yeah, in the Pac-12. I agree. And like I said, that's why, at least for now, you know, we're still in the midst of summer right now, in the dog days of summer. You know, could my opinion change closer to, you know, kickoff the season? Maybe for now, but the, yeah, that's why I'm calling for a 10-2 season. Honestly, I think that that's what we're looking at.
I mean, that's what the roster looks like.
Yeah, like unlikely that they beat Georgia, very unlikely. And then I think, to be honest, just given, like I said, kind of like the newness of this team, unlikely that they beat Utah twice in one season. So, in my humble opinion, if you were going to ask me an early prediction here in July, that's what I would look at. I would say you're looking at a 2-loss team that's heading to a New Year's Six Bowl.
Well, it's what, even if I didn't know what the schedule was, I would say 10-2 simply because that's what this roster looks like. You know, like, you know, it is not yet anyway a roster that looks like Georgia or Alabama or Clemson or Ohio State, where like you, with that roster, it should be a 12-0 season, you know, and yeah. If they lose, it's front page news on Sunday. Like they don't have that roster yet. They have the roster of a 10-2 team.
Yep.
Which, you know, yeah, you know, they're on a trajectory, and it certainly looks like the way that Lanning and co have been recruiting looks like they're, you know, going to continue that trajectory to get there sooner rather than later. You know, it's been quite impressive, you know, this run, it certainly got us all hooked to blue chips. You know, to read Oregon boards that are like panicking over like, oh my God, they're thinking about taking a 3-star. Like this is, you know, hey guys, Alabama has a couple of 3-stars, you know, like Georgia has a couple of 3-stars, but anyway, like, yeah, it's not quite that, you know, it's nothing but 5-stars, you know, roster yet. It's a 10-2 roster. And you look at the schedule and you're like, yeah, this is a 10-2 schedule. And so like, yeah, I would expect 10-2 unless something, you know, goes wrong. You know, but you can never really predict what's going to go wrong. You can sort of, you can give yourself insurance against stuff going wrong by having a well-balanced and experienced roster, which I think they have, but like you can never fully protect yourself from really bad luck. Which, you know, Ducks sort of seem prone to. You know, we've talked about two different goofy ass Stanford losses, which like, I feel like any objective observer would have to conclude similarly that those were goofy. You know, so, you know, who knows, you know, don't take this as betting advice. Don't gamble at all. It's stupid. But like, yeah, this looks like a 10-2 team. I'm looking forward to it. All right, Adam, I think that's going to do us for tonight. You have any parting words for us?
Remember Spencer Webb, you know, raise a glass for him and his family. A tragic loss way too soon. That being said, always hold on to hope and always hold on, you know, to excitement and good feelings. And I think there's a lot of hope and excitement and good feelings surrounding this football team heading into the fall.
Yeah, you bet. All right. Stay safe, everybody. We'll catch you on the flip side.